Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Francis. Every time you get that smirk, I get ready for the snide remark that's coming my way.
No, you change your little intro a little bit every day, and I'm amused by it.
Keeping it fresh. That's what we're doing.
Yeah, okay. So we have a lovely day today. We have Corby Kummer going to join us later on. Corby Kummer is a great food writer. I first started reading his reviews when he was reviewing for, I think it was New York Magazine, 95, 96, 97, something like that. But he's written a couple of great books. He's been nominated for a James Beard Award 3 times. He's written, and he writes for The Atlantic. And he's going to be joining us to talk about Spain, a little bit about slow food, and some things that he's written about recently that I think are really cool. But that's in the later segments of the show. I have to say, you know, we're a little New York-centric, but the New York Times is, although we are national in scope, we visit restaurants all around the country and the world.
And the New York Times gets delivered to my door every morning, so it's a head start.
And it is the paper of record. Mm-hmm. And for those of you who don't live in the area or read the New York Times on a regular basis, the New York Times review is very, very, very important review for New York restaurants.
Easily the most important.
Review. Under the regular review, every Wednesday, and Wednesday is when it comes out, there is a column called the 25 and under column.
And the 25 and under column, what it is it's a column where for $25 or less, you can go to kind of usually a less formal restaurant.
Less expensive restaurant.
Certainly a less expensive restaurant.
The restaurants that would not normally appear in the regular restaurant review because they're not quite that, you know.
Well, they're either underhyped or talked about a little bit less usually.
And they're not.
They're out of the mainstream a little bit.
No, I don't think out of the. I think they're more in the mainstream actually.
Well, I guess that's true.
It's that, you know, in the main restaurant review of the New York Times, 1-star through 4-star restaurants, you're not going to find, you know, the little dive.
Right.
You're not going to find the little corner dive because there are so many restaurants in New York, and it's such an. That's not what the review is about. So 25 and under, I believe it was pioneered by Eric Asimov, who's been on the show,
mm-hmm.
But he was wrote it for many years, and it was terrific.
One of the things that seems to be factual in the 25 and under column is that it's usually a very positive review.
Right,
usually if a place is 25 and under and it's not worth going to, Peter Meehan, who is the current 25 and under reviewer, won't even mention it. He'll only point you towards places that he really
right. Because I mean,
likes.
How newsworthy is it? I went to an inexpensive place. It wasn't very good.
Right.
Terrific. Thank you. You know what I mean? Whereas you know, if you go to one of these high restaurants that's you know charging a lot of money in New York and it's not very good, that is actually newsworthy.
But you know something, and I'll bet this happens a lot to a reviewer. Every once in a while, when you go to a restaurant and you feel like everything is really, really just over the top,
you gotta write
bad,
about it. Yeah.
You have to write about it.
Okay, well, let's look at this review because they have a couple of things that I think that restaurateurs beware and consumers have a right to be leery of.
Restaurateurs beware. Restaurateurs don't be stupid.
Right,
how's
right,
that?
Right. Beware of. I think this is a classic example of offering more than you can deliver, biting off more than you can chew. Trying to be something you're not. Here, the title is called A City Slicker's Take on a Lobster Shack. The restaurant is called Ditch Plains in the West Village. Here's how it starts, by Peter Meehan. It was the whipped cream routine that tipped the scales in the bad way. Our perky waitress at Ditch Plains dropped off our desserts and enthusiastically told us that the chef would deliver whipped cream for our pie to the table. She made the pronouncement with the wide-eyed expression and excited tone you might use when springing an impromptu field trip on a group of school children. Fun was on the way, she was telling us.
Little
okay.
Tableside whipped cream, how cool is that?
It's not cool at all. First of all, even if they got it totally right, who cares?
Well, he's got to be doing something special to it. Why would the chef be coming out? Right?
Wrong. So fun was on the way. So the waitress delivers a pie and says, now the chef will be over to whip cream your pie. And I'm thinking, why couldn't you whip cream my pie? Anyway, but so we think there's going to be some super presentation of tableside whipped cream. Then A harried cook sneaked past her, plopped a canister of supermarket whipped cream on the table, and scurried back to the kitchen. Ta-da!
Okay. Here are the key words there. Cook, scurried, and harried.
And supermarket whipped cream.
And supermarket. I'm sorry, I left one out.
If you do garbage, it doesn't matter how well you present it. You know what I mean? And don't do the whole, the unnecessary flourish. Is you got to be really careful with that. Look, you're going to do Dover sole, and you're going to fillet
table
side.
I don't know. Maybe they were trying to do something tongue in cheek and make fun of the hoity-toity restaurants.
I don't think so.
But failed. Okay. Ta-da.
Here's what he is. A dollop of hand whipped cream would have gone a long way toward making the ploy of charging $8 for lackluster slices of pie, which are not baked on site. Seem like less a way to extract the maximum amount of cash from diners and more like an honestly overpriced yet misguided dessert offering.
Ooh, misguided. Ooh.
So what he's saying is, even if it worked, what are you doing? Why does this chef... Here's I think, what a lot of people miss. And this, we're guilty of this in Jersey. And what I call... You know, my dad used to say there's a fancy restaurant and there's a fancy schmancy restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And the fancy schmancy restaurant's full of, like...
A guy who puts your napkin in your lap for you.
Well, even more than, I mean, some people might consider that a service.
Let go of my napkin.
Get out of my lap. No, but, I mean, the table that brings over, the restaurant that brings over with your espresso, the 9 different colors of rock candy swizzle stick. Who the hell cares? You know what I mean?
I would like the purple rock candy swizzle stick.
But it's...
Because I want my espresso to have a little purple hue.
But it's gesture without substance. And I think that what restaurants need to do is, look, if you're going to fillet a Dover sole tableside, right, or you're going to carve a piece of meat tableside, the reason that a restaurant does that, yes, there's a flourish to it. But there's also an enhanced quality to it. Dover sole, when cooked on the bone and then filleted and served to you immediately in the dining room, first of all, it's a mark of quality because there's a lot of frozen Dover sole out there.
They're showing you the fish.
It's also, if it's filleted like that, that is the best way. You know, Dover sole, brown butter, very simple, but carved in the dining room and presented to you. It's flourish, but it also adds to what's on the plate. This review, this Peter Meehan review where he talks about Ditch Plains, having the waitress say, and the chef will be over in a minute to whipped cream your pie. What difference does it make if the pie came out with whipped cream on it or not?
You know, a lot of times, and even in our own restaurant, some of the waiters will want to do something tableside. And when Francis and I are talking about tableside presentation, certainly it's never a can of whipped cream, but all that being put aside. When we're talking about doing a tableside presentation, one of the things that we talk to the chef or the maitre d' or any person who works in our restaurant for us is, what does this add?
Right.
Is there some kind of crunchy element? You're saucing tableside. Well, are you doing that so that a dish retains some kind of textural element?
Is it all bells and whistles, or is there some substance to it? There's a Texas phrase that I read recently, all hat, no cattle. You know? And that's what I think tableside whipped creaming is all about. We got Corby Cummer coming up for the rest of the show. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio. Central Jersey, 1450. WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Corby Cummer. I first read Corby Cummer's work when he was restaurant reviewer for New York Magazine back in the 90s. He's also been the restaurant critic at Boston Magazine, where you've heard Anthony Giglio, who's the wine critic from there, on the show. His writing for The Atlantic, however, where he is now resident, has pretty much established him as one of the top food writers in the country. The New York Times called his book, The Joy of Coffee, the most definitive and engagingly written book on the subject to date. His recent book, The Pleasures of Slow Food, celebrates local artisans who raise and prepare regional food in traditional ways, as does this show. Sounds like our kind of guy. And he's the recipient of 3 James Beard Awards nominations for journalism, including the MFK Fisher Distinguished Writing Award. And we're honored to have him with us.
Hi, Corby. Corby, how are you today? Welcome to the show.
Corby, are you with us?
Sure am.
Great.
Little engineering problem on our side. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, I read you a lot in the 90s when you were at New Yorker. And at The Atlantic, you do some pretty in-depth work. And what got me, why we decided to call you today, was the article that you did on the Rioja Renaissance, which talked about Spanish wine and Spanish food. Is that a particular interest of yours?
Spain is a great interest of mine. It kind of anybody who's interested in food has to know about Spain the way 15 years ago in the early 90s they had to know about Italy.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I went the first time I went to Europe as a young man sort of banging around, I spent a lot of time there. And that was before the development of the avant-garde cuisine that we see today, you know, our listeners heard us talk about Ferran Adrià and his disciples. So I knew more about traditional food, and now I've gone back and tried some of this avant-garde cuisine. Will you talk to us about how and why avant-garde cuisine got its start and why Spain's the center of it?
Partly it's this guy, Ferran Adrià, whom you have just mentioned, who had a small restaurant. I think his family had been in the business. It served classic Catalan food. It's 2 hours north of Barcelona going toward the mountains of southern France. So it's a region that's always had great food that's been somewhat of a cross between Spanish and Provençal southern French food. That's what he knew, and that's what he started cooking. It was, you know, classic food, but he decided that he had an adventurous streak and he wanted to bring cuisine forward. And he had a scientific bent. It's funny how many chefs studied biology or chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And even though he didn't do that, he wound up using these avant-garde scientific techniques that chefs just hadn't brought into the kitchen before, like freeze-drying food,
mm-hmm.
you know, flaking it, like melting beeswax and making it into a sauce or a hot sauce for pigeon breast or a cold sauce for saffron ice cream. And that is the least adventurous of
yeah.
a lot of the stuff he makes. And what he launched a worldwide revolution. And soon French cooks had to start looking at what he was
kinda,
doing.
Kinda,
almost France to its knees.
Right, almost catching up. Well, I mean, the original food scientists all worked for the big corporations, and now it seems like it's gone into a new arena and been expanded into a place where it's never gone before.
It's a very interesting observation that I would like to follow up on, and thank you for giving me a column idea. and that is this. You know, when you look at these, and I went to this conference, which the most recent column was based on, that all the French chefs, for example, when I heard that all these two- and three-star French chefs were hiking south to Spain
mm-hmm.
to see what Adrià and his disciples were doing at this annual conference in the third week of January, which is a downtime for fancy chefs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's after the holiday season. Usually they travel and they kind of recharge and regroup. And where they all go now is Madrid to see this. I thought, finally, I've got to get a look at this. But they're doing all kinds of science, and it never occurred to me to wonder what the relation to food technology is. There was one guy at this year's conference who was from the food technological world and was trying to give us a history of where that happened. And what I think is that most of these chefs would say is they're taking good, fresh ingredients. They're trying to make new combinations or intensify the flavor that makes you notice it in a way you hadn't before. But that industry is trying to reproduce or artificially enhance or make an artificial experience that they would think is wrong because they're trying to have a genuine but new appreciation of an ingredient. That sounds vague, but it really struck me when I was there because it completely runs against my grain to alter ingredients in some way that doesn't make them recognizable, and I really disliked the whole idea.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I saw the respect they have for the raw ingredients. It's all inspired by Adrià, who really cares about raw ingredients. He shows up at events from Slow Food, the organization I've written a lot about, you know, which are basically farmers' festivals.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He really cares about it. And so even though they are borrowing from food industry techniques, I think that they would say they are very opposed. They have completely different roads they're going along.
You know, I think that we've hit upon, and, you know, I was hoping that, you know, we'd get to this eventually, but may as well start the show with it. I am very disturbed by this, and I've gone to Spain and I've eaten at a bunch of these places, and I've eaten at some of the disciples of avant-garde, what's called, we'll call it avant-garde cuisine,
uh-huh.
here in America. But there is a very dangerous, I think, relationship and a blurring of the lines, as you have a lot of American chefs working with corporations and flavor companies to come up with shelf-stable versions of food. And we'll see who's the slave and who's the master as we go forward. And I think we need to really pay attention to that. We'll be talking more with that about that with Corby Kummer of The Atlantic, one of the best food writers in America, in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest is Corby Kummer. He's a fantabulous writer. He's written, most germane to this conversation, he writes for The Atlantic, and he's also written a book on the pleasures of slow food. Corby, we were talking before about how this new avant-garde cuisine is sort of working with food technology. And we're saying that the Ferran Adrià and his immediate disciples have a great respect for the traditionally produced ingredients, and then they work with them in different ways. But there's also a movement going on in the United States where guys like, say, David Burke are working with major flavor companies to come out with products like Flavor Spray, which is this thing that's shelf stable and goes on the supermarket shelf, and he's trying to go with this to paint himself as a disciple of this school of avant-garde cuisine, coming out with a spray that you can buy in the supermarket and spray on your food and make it taste good. There's a difference there, isn't there? I mean, are we clouding things a little bit?
Of course, that's where we exactly do not want this experimentation to end up. Losing any kind of connection to the real food. I have to say, though, that even at this conference in Madrid, where lots of chefs were gathered to see what is the latest in technology, there were a lot of flavorings that they were using.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they would put it with scallops, and it might be an essence of mizuna or some Japanese herb that wasn't easily available, and they thought would enhance it in a way that would make you taste things differently. And you know, the idea, it's so curious, because the idea is almost to blindfold you.
Yep.
It's to make you unaware and surprised by what you're tasting. And when Adrià, who's the kind of godfather of all this, the inspirational figure, Ferran Adrià, began his presentation, the whole thing was quite self-indulgent, even though I admire him, because he started with a long video, and the video was people at his restaurant, and they were looking at each other as if they were having an orgasm with an extraterrestrial.
And let me tell you something. I pay a lot on the preview menu for a reaction like that. But we have to take a break for the news, but we'll be back right after the news with a nice long segment to get in a little more about what's going on in high-end food today. This is really exciting stuff, and remnants of it are even showing up on your supermarket shelf. So stick with us through the news. Corby Kummer is our guest. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Today we're joined by Corby Kummer. He writes for The Atlantic. He's also written several books, and we're talking today with him specifically about Spanish cuisine, and we'll be talking in a moment about Spanish wine.
So, Corby, do you feel, I definitely see some of the people, and Francis was talking about going off the rails earlier, that for some of the people, some of these disciples of Adria with this avant-garde cuisine, it has become more about surprising you than it has about delivering a pleasurable meal. Do you feel that some people are going that way, or is this the way, the future of food?
I hope not. The surprise element is certainly key, but also it's competition among themselves. Like when Nouvelle Cuisine came in the 70s, chefs had to do it, and it was not so much for what people wanted to eat, because a lot of people didn't like it, but what they wanted to say is, I'm in the avant-garde, I'm doing it for myself as much to others. And one of the chief realizations and kind of revelations I had when I went to this Madrid conference where these chefs from all over Europe and a lot in America, I live in Boston, talking to you from the Atlantic's headquarters in Washington today, but where we have a great Spanish disciple of Adria's himself. And it's kind of like the chief disciple in this country of Adria is right here. It's Jose Andres in Washington.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we go to his restaurants all the time. We love them.
Love him.
Right.
Love
him. And it was he actually who expressed better than anyone what a lot of people said, including the Boston chefs, all these young chefs I did not expect to see. They paid their own way. You know, it was expensive to get to Madrid for these 3 days. They want to be artists, and they want to feel like they are expressing themselves in food. And, you know, slow food is very fashionable, and I hope I've had something to do with that, and it sounds like you guys are having plenty to do with it where you are. They're trying to bring genuine flavors, things that have been appreciated in the past that are increasingly hard to find, that have, you know, real flavor, authentic, genuine ingredients, whatever those are, trying to hunt them up. But for a lot of young chefs, what they want to do is express themselves artistically. Mm-hmm. They see in these new high-tech, newfangled, frankly strange techniques a way of setting themselves apart from other chefs and exploring their own creative urges. And Jose Andres, this disciple of Adria's, whom you like and is right here in Washington, said, you know, if I'm a farmer, I can give you an apple. If I'm a chef and an artist, I have to do something with that apple.
You know, I've heard that quote before, and I've had his food, and I've had the great experience of having probably Adria's number one disciple in Spain is Paco Roncero at La Terraza de Casino in Madrid.
Right.
And I've eaten his food as well, and I really like both of their food. But I've gone to some places, and you know, the farmer has given the chef that apple, and they've made a paper airplane out of it.
Yeah.
And I've
right.
said, well, that's great, but why do I want to eat that?
You or know? Menu you can eat.
Yeah, exactly. Why do I want to eat the menu? You know, it's now if you make a menu that I can eat, and when I eat that menu, I go, wow, that menu tasted great. But that's not what happens. You know, it's like you eat the menu and it's sort of acceptable. You know what I mean? You're like, it's interesting that I can eat the menu and it's acceptable, but I don't particularly want to have another one. You know what I mean?
It's the sheer novelty value of it. And my brother, who lives in New York and goes to some of these restaurants, said, it's like listening to Stockhausen's music. It's a rearranging of things in this strange, interesting way, but after the end of it, you don't crave another one.
Sometimes I find myself eating this food and saying, that was great. Can I have a potato chip?
Although down at Cafe Atlantico, you know, mm-hmm. there's the mini bar Cafe Atlantico, and certainly in La Terraza in Madrid, I did want to go back.
Sure, sure. I think when this food is done well, it is interesting, and it is the edge of cuisine. But I think it's so easy to make mistakes with this.
I guess one of the chief rules, when you mention Atlantico and the restaurant, Haleo, and the restaurants down here in Washington that Andres has, it's somebody who knows the rules before he starts to break them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He started working for Adria when Adria was still doing regional Catalan food.
Right.
So he grew with him as Adria went off on these weird experimental tangents. And so he really knows how to make that genuine food, and he makes plenty of it at a number of his restaurants. And I think that some of the chefs that we all kind of have trouble with might not really even know it or have an appreciation of it because they want to kind of vault ahead into the future.
Well, you know, it seems to me that that cuisine, it seems to Mark and I both, that cuisine today in restaurants and also in the press and hopefully somewhat in people's homes is going in two directions. There's the slow food thing on one side where we're going back to eating locally, eating sustainably, traditional ways of producing food, traditional ways of cooking food. And on the other side, we have this avant-garde cuisine taking hold primarily in the top restaurants and in some great books. And, you know, you can't swing a dead cat in New York without having, you know, hitting a puff of foam on top of a soup somewhere.
Mm.
But other than that, I mean, I think and I hope, and it's my greatest hope, that the slow food movement will have a long and profound impact on the way Americans eat in restaurants, and hopefully that will filter down to people's homes. What impact do you think avant-garde cuisine is going to have in restaurants and in people's homes? Do you think it's going to have any, or do you think it's a flash in the pan? Or a foam in the soup?
You know, I wish it were, you know, I wish all the foams would subside and recede. And it were a flash in the
Thank pan. You. I just want to thank you for going with my analogy. That was beautiful of you.
Right, the flash in the pan would burn into an old charred spark.
Not as successful as the foam one, but still
okay,
okay.
Very good.
I always need an editor. I'm worried that it won't, though. Because, for example, I had my first foam experience at David Boulay's late restaurant called Just Boulay when I was New York restaurant critic in the mid-90s.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I thought, what did this piece of, maybe it was Dover sole, it was a very firm-fleshed white fish, what did it do to deserve this strange, beige, lukewarm foam that might well have had something on the order of monkfish liver, which is now very popular to foam in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that this was incredibly effective, pretentious, and it would go away. And it hasn't at all gone away. And here we are 15 years later. And I found out the underlying strategy for foams. It's anything with bubbles in it reaches your taste buds faster, permeates them, and it's giving you this more sudden flavor impact than anything else does. And of course, for a chef, it's very cheap to buy a siphon and a carbon dioxide injection foam and just put anything into that siphon.
I have had some foams that really added. Like I had a Parmesan foam on a soup that was really sort of mind blowing. But most
as a textural counterpoint, I think is where I most enjoy foams. But
it's that when everyone's
it's so
like,
overdone.
Like you feel you have to have a foam on everything. It's like, you know, the goat cheese and sun-dried tomato restaurant of 1987.
Yes,
oh my God,
yes,
stop
yes,
it already.
Yes, yes. And what might be the next one is something that a lot of chefs were doing in variations at the Madrid conference this year, which is flash frying chicken skin and or fish skin, and there's this new protein powder that can bind it to, let's say, a dull piece of flounder. In other words, something that has no crispy texture, has no fat, as if it is the skin of that thing. They could do it for a vegetable. And, you know, it's like genetically modified food gone mad.
Right. Yeah. Don't put the fish skin on my apple.
Yes.
Right, but they're gonna do it.
And you can't. I gotta tell you, we gotta take a quick break. But I will tell you that I was over someone's house, and they were making dinner, and I saw they had a thing to make foam and at their home. And I thought, don't you dare. Our guest
foam
is
in the home.
Oh, that's nice. I like that. That's another article. Our guest is Corby Kummer. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45. Economy Paver and Restaurant Supply Company is the oldest dealership in New Jersey. They've been equipping and supplying restaurants since 1932, and they know that to make great food, you need great equipment. You need equipment that doesn't break down, and you can't pay too much for it. Whether you need an emergency replacement or a wholesale kitchen renovation, Economy's knowledge, experience, and integrity are indispensable. Economy Paver and Restaurant Supply is a recognized dealer for all major brands, and they specialize in custom fabrication and ventilation. At Economy, they've got all the tools you need to get the job done, all in one place, all priced right, and delivered to your door. Economy is the only dealer in New Jersey that's an approved for on-site demonstrations of the Rational Combi Oven. The Rational Combi Oven is an innovative combination of convection and adjustable steam oven. It's a powerful and versatile tool in your kitchen's arsenal. They also supply competitively priced paper products and all the non-food supplies every restaurant needs. You can visit the Economy Demo Kitchen on Broad Street in Clifton, New Jersey. You can also visit economysupply.com, then call them at 973-279-5500. That's 973-279-5500.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey everyone, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guest today is Corby Kummer. You've heard us talking about avant-garde cuisine, and it's been emailed to us that we should let you know some places where you can actually go and try this cuisine in the United States. Jose Andres has several places in Washington, D.C., a very hard reservation to get. He has a very small bar inside his restaurant, Cafe Atlantico, which is called the mini bar at Cafe Atlantico. And in New York City, you can try Wiley DeFrenze's food at WD50, or if you're in Chicago, you can go to Moto, or you can fly off to Madrid, and you can go to La Terraza at the casino at the in Madrid, and we'll put all that up on our website for you.
And Corby also mentioned a little restaurant, a tapas restaurant in D.C., which is one of my favorite restaurants in the world, a place called Haleo.
Love that place. Not avant-garde cuisine, but we love that place. Now, Corby, we've been talking all about food, but let's talk a little bit about wine. We had Jerry Dawes on the show last week talking about Spanish wine, and there's sort of a revolution going on in Spanish wine as well, and in your article that you wrote, The Rioja Renaissance, in The Atlantic Online, I read it, you talk about how some of the very things that were challenges to Spanish wines are also the blessings of Spanish wine. Will you talk to us about that?
Yeah. In fact, there's nothing I can tell you that Jerry Dawes can't say better. He's one of my gurus.
Yeah, he's awesome.
What was great about it is they hadn't improved themselves. That is, they still had old vines that were often as much as a century old. They were planted far from each other.
Just one second. It's generally accepted in the wine world that the older your vines are, the better your wine's going
to
be.
Right. But it's not very economical to have old vines, though. So in places where there's good economy, very often the old vines don't survive. But in Spain, because it was neglected, those old vines were still there.
It's exactly like going to a city that still has beautiful buildings because they were too poor to rebuild.
Right, right, exactly.
they didn't have the money to put in improved varieties, so they still have older ones that are much lower yielding, you know, many fewer grapes, but those grapes have much more intensive flavor.
Mm-hmm.
There had been a long time ban on pesticides and fertilizers in Spain. I'm not quite sure what the origin of that ban was, but it managed to keep a lot of land organic. As always, organic is this new concept that applies to old methods of farming,
mm-hmm.
pre-chemicals. So there hadn't been a lot of chemicals. And they were still using old techniques because they didn't have the money to buy stainless steel machines, which only arrived in mass in the 70s in Spain. And so there were just a lot of older techniques that sometimes produce messy, muddy wines, which is what any wine technician from UC, University of California, Davis would tell you. But, you know, a lot of times produced very intensely flavored wines. And Rioja, which is the subject that I decided to focus on, itself was using the same qualities that Bordeaux wine did, with similar grapes and identical methods to what Bordeaux had been using kind of from the 1870s through the 1920s. But it had never changed because the Spanish Revolution meant that everything kind of got arrested. It was arrested development. So there was still this great wine that was the equal of Bordeaux coming out, but nobody knew about it except as this cheap Bordeaux substitute.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and so now you have a situation where, like you said, like a building, its architecture was preserved because when the time that in the 70s and 80s we were knocking down all those beautiful old buildings to put up our modern garbage, they didn't have the money to keep up. But now there is a lot of money flowing into Spain. Spanish wines, like Spanish food, are very fashionable, and maybe some of the traditional Spanish wine is facing the same problems as the traditional Spanish food as people seek more and more to get the modern wines out of Spain. So I see coming out of Spain now more and more, you know, oak barrels like we use to make California Cabernet Sauvignon, more stainless steel tanks, more big forward fruity wines. Are the old Spanish wines in danger?
Of course they are, yeah, because everybody has been inculcated in the Robert Parker strategy of wines that clobber you with their oakiness, their power.
Just for our listeners, Robert Parker is the wine critic that we often talk about, who's the most influential wine critic, most influential critic of any sort anywhere in the world. And what we're talking about with Corby is that, you know, because he is so influential, people change the way they make wine sometimes to appeal to his specific palate. And sometimes that's at the expense of traditional wines. And that's going on?
It very much is. And it's happening in Spain. There are wine importers who are planting wines that they know will appeal to Parker, and grapes that will mimic the very powerful, forward, fruity, high-alcohol, hot wines, as they're called, that he often gives very high ratings to. And, you know, he would consider some of the more traditional Spanish varieties as being wimpy, low-flavored, juicy, watery, you know, things that kind of normal wine people like and don't notice. They don't have jaded palates. You know, they like wine, so I think a lot of the subtleties might be erased, as really they have been in France.
But don't we lose what classic Rioja is as we move towards Robert Parker's palate?
Well, luckily there seem to be a lot of really good Riojas that are available. And I discovered that it's now one of those fail-safes in restaurants now.
Yeah.
That if I order a Gran Reserva, one of the great things about buying it at a wine store is part of the rules of calling a Gran Reserva is that it's been aged 3 years, two of them in oak barrels.
That's at the winery. So it's got, whereas Bordeaux we drink very young, the Rioja has to be older before it's even released.
Yeah, it's all set to drink. So you don't have this calculation looking at your watch, looking at your calendar, you know, wondering, is this really at its best? Well, they put it in the bottle when it's at its best and ready, so you don't have to think about it.
Yeah,
I remember our third partner in the restaurant is a little bit of a wine head and reads Parker all the time. And I remember it was New Year's Day, January 1st, 2005, and he popped open a bottle of Bordeaux and he said, "Parker said this would be ready in 2005. Let's drink it."
We drank it at 12:01 a.m. Our guest is Corby Kummer. We're talking about Spanish food and wine. We'll be back in just a second with the restaurant guys. Central Jersey, 14:50. The time is 11:55.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. We are honored today to have Corby Kummer, writer for The Atlantic and many other things, on our show as our guest. You know, we were talking about traditional Spanish wines, and it's funny because yesterday's New York Times had an article by Eric Asimov, who's also been on the show, and he was talking about the region of Bierzo, where it's a recently discovered region by the rest of the Western world, and they're facing the same problem. In Bierzo, the traditional grape is Mencia, and they make traditional wines from Mencia, but now that people are clamoring for Bierzo, there are certain producers pulling up the Mencia and putting down Cabernet Sauvignon
and Merlot
because it's more accessible to people. I mean, isn't that a shame?
This is the universal plague of winemakers and traditional winemakers. When I wrote my book on slow food, I had to pummel Jancis Robinson, whom I think is a great wine writer, to find me somebody who was still planting traditional grapes and old, out-of-the-way grapes that had gone out of fashion. She is incredibly generous, and she pointed me to some people in southwest France. But almost universally, it is people are pulling them out for Cabernet and Merlot or, you know, say, Chardonnay, and these fashionable grapes. And it's so improvident.
Yeah.
You know, if some of these winemakers in the region Eric was writing about were, for example, you know, taking one portion where their traditional grapes, say, didn't even grow that well, and were saying, maybe I can make more money and for Merlot or Cabernet, I'll do it for a few years, then that fashion is going to fade. But in fact, they generally wholesale pull them out, and they're gone.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Crazy. You know, Corby, we say shame, you say universal plague. You know, we say tomato, you say tomato.
You guys better vocabulary. You're a writer. You guys, we're just radio guys. You know what I mean? Hey, Corby, this has been a ton of fun.
Really great.
I have
like seven more pages of questions for you. Will you come back on the show someday?
We're still on page one.
Pleasure.
Oh, great. That's super. Corby, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Corby.
That's Corby Kummer. If you want to find out about Corby Kummer, you can go to the Atlantic Online, where he is resident and writes all the time. He's one of the best food writers in America. His book, The Joy of Coffee, was called by the New York Times the most definitive and engagingly written book on the subject to date. His book, The Pleasures of Slow Food, is really what we're all about, and you can link to all of that from our website on restaurantguysradio.com. Hope you've enjoyed the hour. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.